welcome to OK Sis Podcast.
Hi, sisters. I'm Maddie.
And I'm Scout.
And we are sisters IRL.
I'm the older one.
Yes, Scout, we know.
We're cultural observers.
And of curious minds.
Get ready for sisterly banter while we chat about fixations, learnings, and personal growth.
We promise it'll be a good time.
As long as you don't get too loud, Mads.
Welcome to the sisterhood!
Hello, my fellow bibliophiles. It is Mads, but you already know that because you know the sound of my voice. And here we are on month 3 of the OK Sis Book Club, Romance Novel Edition. Hopefully, if you're listening to this, you have read The Soulmate Equation by Christina Lauren, which was June's book club pick. But if you have not, do not worry because I'm going to quickly summarize the book before getting into my conversation with the authors themselves, Christina and Lauren. If you haven't already, be sure to join our book club group chat on Bunches to discuss the book of the month along with other recommendations. There are so many awesome other female readers in there, so we'd love to have you in the community as well. The link to join can be found in the show notes and on our Instagram link in bio. So June's book club pick was The Soulmate Equation, which is about single mom Jessica Davis, who is a data and statistics wizard, and she is weary of re-entering into the dating world. Jess hears about Genetic Ally, which is a buzzy new DNA-based matchmaking company that's predicted to change dating forever. Finding a soulmate through DNA? I mean, that's something that she understands. At least she thought she did until her test shows an unheard of 98% compatibility. Wow, why can't I say that word? Compatibility with another subject in the database, one of Genetic Ally's founders, Dr. River. She knows River to be stuck up and stubborn because he visits her local coffee shop and she sees him all the time. He's very brooding and, you know, stubborn. So she doesn't believe the results were correct, and she definitely does not believe that River is her soulmate. But Genetic Ally says that they'll pay her to get to know him as this PR stunt that's, you know, leading up to their launch to make it this whole marketing strategy. Jess, who is barely making ends meet, is in no position to turn it down. So despite her skepticism about the project and her dislike for River, she goes with it. So as the pair get to know each other, Jess begins to realize that there might be more to the scientist and the science behind a soulmate than she thought. All right, without further ado, let's get into today's discussion on The Soulmate Equation with Christina Hobbs and Lauren Billings.
Hello!
Hello! Hello, how are you?
I'm doing so good. I am so excited to speak with you. First of all, how many times a day do you guys get mistaken for one person?
Not as much anymore.
Okay.
I think, like, yeah, it's definitely, I mean, for people who don't know our books, we still will get some people not knowing, but
sometimes we confuse people and they think we're like a they, like, you know what I mean?
It's like, no,
which is fine.
It's fine. Not, yeah. But so I have been a fan of both of you for so long, and I actually was one of those people that thought you were one person, you know, until someone was like, oh yeah, they wrote this. I was like, wait, oh, there's two of them. Fabulous. I mean, the more the merrier.
The more the merrier.
Exactly. That's my philosophy. So I'm so curious, how did you both become writing partners? Because to me, writing feels like such a, you know, internal and solo activity. So it's so fascinating that you guys have coupled up to write these incredible stories.
So this is Christina. Hello.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's do a little like introduce yourself so we can determine.
So we met in 2009 at San Diego Comic-Con. We were both writing fan fiction at the time and like sort of emailing and reading each other's stories. And then Lo was doing, like putting on a panel on Fanworks and invited me to come down. And so we met, for the first time there and just had so much fun and got along. And like, strangely, we're just like, do you want to write a story together? So we wrote like a little short story together, like a, one shot, a fan fiction one shot. And then we're like, we had so much fun. We were like, hey, do you want to write a book together? And we just decided to do that, like you do, I guess. And we wrote a book about like skinny dipping and, you know, magical powers and stuff that we've never published. And but it got us our agent. And then we eventually sold the book. And here we are 27 books later.
27 books. I mean, that's so incredible that you guys met in San Diego, because the book in question that we're going to be discussing today, The Soulmate Equation, is set in San Diego. I am actually from San Diego, born and raised. So I was so delighted to see Bontai and La Jolla and all these places. Have you guys lived there before, or what was the, why is San Diego special to you for this book's particular?
So the location of the apartment building is actually a real building that's on Park Avenue, and it's owned by my family. So my aunt and uncle bought that apartment building when they had both completely retired as a way to, as like investment, right? So they bought it, initially they rented out all the units, and then when they were sort of too old to easily navigate all the stairs in their house, they sold their house in Mission Hills. And because they lived on this super steep hill, and they sold that house and moved into units in the apartment building. And then my cousin Amy moved in, and then my cousin Matt and his family moved in. He's a chef. He is like the head pastries chef for the convention center. And so they just all live there, and Matt has two kids, and it's like just how it's sort of described in the book.
It is. It's just as wonderful.
I know. Mm-hmm. And it's such a, yeah, like it seems like such a family affair, such a family bonding place. And so do you guys usually get a lot of inspiration from your family, from people? I kind of ask this a lot of authors, like, where do you get inspiration for names of characters? Like, is it actually named after people that you know, or do you have like this like laundry list of names that you choose from?
We have a list of names that we keep in a notes app. And sort of, we have some that we've kept forever that we want to use some point, but they just never fit the character we're writing. In the case of this book, you know, Jess, her name is Jessica Marie Davis. So we wanted a name that was like pretty common, because the whole point is that she's got, you know, she's named a J, her mother is a J, her grandmother is a J. And so she kind of felt like she was going to name her daughter a J, but she wanted to give her daughter an interesting name, because she's always had sort of a common name. So she names her Juno, which is a name we love. And Juno and the love interest for Jess, River, they bond over this, you know, both having unique names. And so we wanted River's name to be, you know, something that's like different in the same way that Juno is, where it's like a unique name. But, you know, so it's cute. Like, we had sort of decided that they would both have unique names. But most of the time we just kind of go through our list and decide what feels like it fits the characters, you know?
Yeah. So River to me gives off Mr. Darcy vibes. You guys probably, you know, thought of this ahead of time.
Yeah.
Was that an inspiration for his character and this like brooding, you know, man? Obviously calling her average, I think that like really stuck out to most people with that parallel. Ooh. But was that something that you guys intentionally put in there?
He has a lot of Darcy vibes in there, but also he's just a scientist. And so like when he calls her average, he doesn't necessarily mean it as an insult. Like, to be average is to be average. And, you know, so he doesn't necessarily mean it that way. And then also, you know, a lot of the times when he's walking in and like Lo wrote the like stride, stride, stride as he walks in, it's not even that he's intentionally being rude. He's just so stuck in his head. Lo is a scientist. She was a neuroscientist before this. Then her husband is a scientist. And so I see her husband sometimes when he's in that like science mode. And so it's just that he's just so lost in what he's doing and, you know, the things going on in his head that he's just not noticing anyone else.
Totally. Yeah. It's interesting because it seems like this insult, but then you learn about River and you understand that they are their minds just work in such a different way. It's more this analytical, pragmatic way of being. And yeah, there's something wrong with it. It's not insulting. It's just the way that their DNA, you know, I'll just throw that in there, is made up. I kind of want to go back because you said that Lauren created the stride of him, and then you kind of brought in elements of other parts of your writing. So what is the process like when you're writing together? Do you actually separate it out by themes or by chapters, or what does that actual process look like?
So we always outline together in person. Okay. The only exception to this has been in the pandemic. We weren't able to do that for the book that we just finished, which is next year's book, but it was okay. That still worked all right. But there's generally like just a vibe that happens when we're in the room together and we're on a trip together and we outline and we sort of talk it out and spend some time thinking about the book. And then we go do some stupid best friend stuff. And then we come back and we cook dinner. And as we're cooking dinner, we talk a little bit more about the book. And that's sort of how it fleshes out. And then we go to our respective places. I'm in California, Christina's in Utah. And we usually alternate chapters. So if it's one point of view like this book, you know, I'll do like 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, she'll do 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. And we just draft pretty quick. It's gotten cleaner as we've done this longer, but we give ourselves permission to draft a little bit messy because we spend a ton of time in edits. And the reason we do that is we want it to sound like one voice. And so when you're talking about whether one of us handles certain things, I think in edits, that's probably where that happens more, because we definitely draft equally. But when we're editing, there's certain things that I leave for Christina to add in. Like I might say, like, you know, describe this location better. And she'll come in and she'll do like a good description of the location. Or there might be some science stuff that she'll say, make science-y, you know, and she'll leave for me. And so I'll come in and I'll do those edits. And so, you know, we draft equally, but then we edit a little bit more fine-tuned to our specialty.
Absolutely. Okay, so then I need to ask, who writes the sex scenes?
We both do. Okay. I mean, historically speaking, like I don't think there's one of us that's done more of that. It also just depends on where it falls in the outline, or if it's a dual point of view book and more of the sex scenes are in her point of view, for example, then whoever's writing the female character will tend to write those. But, yeah, we both do that stuff.
Love yeah. It. I mean, so I recently got into romance novels, and, you know, something that really stuck out to me in The Soulmate Equation was that Fizzy, which is Jess's, you know, wacky best friend, she is a romance novelist in the book. And so it felt very meta, but she brings up this stigma that romance novels have, where, you know, people can perceive them as trashy or guilty or like chick lit. And I've been loving asking all the authors that come on OK Sis, you know, I probably had that connotation with them as well, which is probably why I hesitated to read romance novels. And now I am just so dazzled with how warm and beautiful and like and beautifully written these stories are. Like, I don't know where this whole perception came, and I think it's shifting a lot recently, which is amazing. So I just want to hear, you know, your thoughts on the genre in general, and then kind of why you made sure to insert that into Fizzy.
We've talked a lot about how we think, like, as a society, we tend to like think that things that are full of pain and suffering are somehow more valid or important than talking about joy or love. And particularly in the pandemic, people just needed a happily ever after. They just needed to know, no matter what we take you on, it's going to be okay in the end. Because none of us knew that for sure. So I feel like hopefully that's getting better. But also, you know, some people have this idea that romance novels are like, he tears her bodice and throws her over the back of her horse or whatever. And romance novels are very feminist. They're very modern. I feel like a lot of social change happens in romance first, particularly like right now about consent and diversity, things like that. And then I actually think writing romance is hard because people know how the story is going to end. And you know that they're going to get together in the end, and you still have to maintain that tension and keep people turning the pages. And that's a tough thing to do. It's like knowing who the murderer is on the first page.
The other day, my cousin looked at me and asked if I got a treatment in my hair. I said no, but I am taking Nutrafol. You see, sisters, I had some shedding issues postpartum when it came to my hair, so I made it my mission to support my hair growth and strengthen my hair. I mean, Mads, you saw my hair last time I was up in LA, and you even complimented me. Which, sisters, you know that when Mads compliments me, it's a big deal.
I do have to give this one to you, Scout. Your hair is looking thick, strong, and beautiful. When it comes to hair thinning, it's complicated. The problem is, it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker and stronger hair.
Every morning after I eat breakfast, I take 4 pills, and it becomes a seamless addition to my morning routine. But the reason I decided to go with Nutrafol when supporting my hair health is that Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding. Oh, also, Nutrafol makes the best Mother's Day present, especially for new moms. The perfect way to show them that you care about their postpartum support.
Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month's subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code OKSIS. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code OKAYSIS. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code OKSIS. That's so true. Have you guys always been romance novel fans, or is this something that you've recently also, like, since you started writing it, became more involved?
We've always been romance readers. I mean, I think both of us, that was what we gravitated to when we were, you know, getting, when you're old enough to really choose what you're picking up. And for me, that was probably around the age of 12 or 13 when I started having my own opinions and using my allowance to go to the used bookstore and get Danielle Steele books. You know, I think there's a whole bunch of us that, like, we're just always sort of oriented towards swoony books. You know, we just wanted stories that had love stories as a primary story arc. So yeah, I mean, I had been writing since I was younger. Christina discovered writing, her love for writing, through fan fiction. And I think that just, like, writing romance was something we naturally gravitated toward. We have so much fun doing it. And when we write together, it's, you know, it's almost, it's not easier, because there are challenges that are present with co-authoring that aren't present when you're writing alone. But you have an audience of one. My only job is to entertain Christina. Her job is to entertain me. If we are both happy with the outcome, we can be pretty sure that our readers are going to like the book. Like, that's a tried and true formula at that point. So it's just nice that we have this one opinion that matters. And given that we're both romance fans, you know, that's sort of where we are. It's where we lie.
I love that. I love that you guys are so in tune with the readers, and it definitely, it feels that way. It comes off the page. So I want to talk about just in general synopsis of this book. I mean, it was so incredible. And again, with the tension, and I also had no idea where this was going to go. I was like, there's no way they're 98%, but, like, maybe, but, you know, so where did this idea originate? And honestly, I think we need a dating app that's like this, right? Or is there one that exists? Like, it's kind of rad.
I mean, companies have tried. You know, there are some companies that have tried to do matchmaking based on DNA. The issue is that they're looking at a handful of DNA signatures. And, you know, not to get too philosophical about it, but if you're looking for similarity in your genome, that's sort of eugenics-y, right? You're sort of looking for people who have a similar gene, which, you know, arguably is not the best way to find eternal happiness.
Yeah, it's like the opposites attract. It's like, yeah, why would you want to marry someone that's like your exact replica?
And,
yeah.
Or if they're looking at a sort of a compatibility signature, there's no way that they're doing a longitudinal study that's big enough to really look down the road 30 years in marriages, right? So in fiction, we can do that because we have the time, right? We can pretend that this research has been going on for this many years before the book opens. And so in this case, we say, okay, well, it started 10 to 13 years ago. They've been tracking happily married couples for this number of years, and they have this huge collection of genes that contributes to like a different algorithm that we like put into a neural network, and it comes out with an answer at the end. So we get to do a bit of hand waving in fiction. But, you know, when we were talking about how to make this, you know, we did some research, and there were some companies that were trying to do matchmaking based on DNA signatures, but they were looking at like 3 or 4 genes. So the way that we were thinking about that was, okay, well, if you have a genome of 20 to 25,000 genes and somebody's looking at 4, that's like giving a dating questionnaire of 20,000 questions and you overlap with somebody on 4 questions. Like, that's just not super predictive.
Right.
And so we wanted to think about it. Well, like, it's this whole array of genes. You're looking at patterns, you're looking at compatibility, you're looking at things that can predict long-term happiness. And it was just kind of fun. We just got to be sort of dorky about it, you know? And I think a lot of that came from, we were doing 23andMe, you know, we're looking at ancestry, you just spit into a vial and you learn all this stuff about yourself and your family. And so it does seem a little bit like, why not dating, you know?
I love that. So do you guys have a number of what their compatibility actually was at the end? Or you're just like, we'll leave it to the reader to imagine what it would be.
I mean, we had it in the book, I think, right? And then,
did you?
No. I'm asking Christina, because I think we had it in the book and our editor was like, let's leave it a little bit mysterious.
Let's leave it on.
And so some readers have like been like, I love that we don't know. And other readers are DMing us like, what is
it? Yeah, they're like, what is it?
We had a totally different thing where like, he doesn't look, or, you know, he does. It was like this discussion. Yeah.
But we do.
I mean, he wasn't completely, or it didn't feel like he was that worried about the number. So I think it was pretty
well,
high.
I mean, we do we have, and I think it's in the epilogue. It says something like our new diamond match. So we know there's still a diamond.
Okay. Yeah. That's good. That's all we need to know. So let's talk about Juno, because she is just this ray of sunshine throughout this whole book. And, you know, Jess is a single mother. There's that whole dynamic of her and her grandparents and, you know, her also not having very reliable parents that had left her, and she feels abandoned in that way. Why all these other themes that pile onto her as a character? Why was that important for you all to uncover? I mean, we see, you know, a really tragic moment where she has to go pick up her mom from, you know, this party. And, you know, it does add so much depth to Jess and what she's experienced and what she's been through. But would love to hear kind of just the making of her and why all those parts fit.
I think it's because like every decision that Jess makes is for Juno, and her like decision whether or not she's going to like pursue things with River is because of Juno, and whether or not she should date is because of Juno and her mother, and needing money for ballet and health insurance and all of those things. So it's like her motivation. Everything that she does is to not be her mother, to be a better mother than hers was, to, you know, like deciding not to date in the beginning. She doesn't want to like disrupt Juno's life and have guys in and out of her life in the way that it was for her. So that's why, you know, she tells Fizzy early in the book that she's just not gonna date until Juno is in college, and Fizzy is just not here for that at all. But to, you know, to Jess, it sounds totally logical that that's what she would do. So I think, when we decided that she was going to be a mom, it's, you know, part of that was because like we're moms and everything we do is like this balance of guilt. Like as a mom, like we are a vessel of guilt. We think every decision we make somehow impacts our children negatively. So I just think like that just made Jess who she is.
Yeah. I mean, you, she's so young too. So it is frustrating because, I mean, I think she's even my age, and I feel like I wanted to shake her and say, no, like go out, live your life and date and have these fun experiences. But obviously being a mother, that is an experience
that matures you exponentially and makes you think of obviously a lot of other people in your life that you have to adhere to. So I totally see that balance in every decision that she made. And I mean, I think River being as patient and amazing to Juno was just the best piece of it all, because I think for that, for her, then it was okay, I can see him fitting into this story of mine. And he was so loving towards that. Why do you think that was? Like, why do you think River was so game to just drop everything and pick up Juno from school that one time and really become completely selfless? I mean, we soon realize at the end that he is that person, but it seemed very out of character for him, at least in that first time that he did that for her.
I mean, I think there's a couple different reasons. One is that, you know, the number 98 gets Jess interested, but it wouldn't work for her if he wasn't also perfect for her daughter. Whereas for River, he sees that number and immediately is like, okay, what do I have to do to explore this, right? But there's also a piece that I think we haven't really talked about, because not that many people have mentioned it, which is that if Jess is a 98 for River and all of this is based on DNA, Juno has Jess's DNA. There's going to be a connection between Juno and River too that transcends, you know, any of the sort of, you know, it's measurable. This is the science that he believes in. And so River is going to feel a connection to Juno in some of the same way that he feels a connection to Jess. So I think there's both the piece of him wanting to be whatever person he has to be to make that 98 make sense to him. But also there's a piece of him that's just, he doesn't completely control, that is drawn to Juno as well. And so, you know, you see a little bit of that at the end when they're at the science fair and she sits up straight and he sits up straight and Jess is kind of just looking at them like she's not biologically his, but she is biologically his because Jess is biologically his, right?
Wow.
And that was just a fun layer, I think, of the romance, is when you have this, you know, obviously platonic romance between a father figure and this little girl.
Yeah, I mean, exactly what we were just saying, that a DNA match doesn't necessarily mean it has to be romantic. It can be just compatible, right, in any other type of situation and relationship that you have in life. That's an amazing, right. Oh my God, wow, yep, I didn't put that together, but now we put it together. Okay, so you guys mentioned that you have another book coming out next year. How next week, you know, one a week. How long does this process take? It feels like you guys are like spitting them out every year. It's amazing.
Our answer is that it takes us as long as you give us. we have written a book in 6 weeks before, and we have written a book in 6 months, or it just depends. We've slowed down a little bit just because our books have like more world to them now. They're like bigger, they're a little more complicated, and that just takes some time sometimes for things to really work out. Our next book is like a play on Romancing the Stone meets The Hangover, and so it's like this treasure hunt through the desert, and we had to like build this treasure hunt and, you know, all of these things that took so much more planning and stuff than two people falling in love is hard, don't you know, on its own, but then adding in this other layer of stuff. So it's just nice to have more time to like let it percolate a little bit and then go back and have lots of time to change things and fix things. And
also, like, we wrote our first year, we had 6 books out, and we had all these ideas that we had probably both been just like mentally chewing on for a few years, at least, if not more. But that's the low hanging fruit, you know, like once you get 27 books
in, you're
like,
what do
I do? What have we not done yet, you know?
What's around me?
You're like, what stories do we need to tell? And what have we already done? And I mean, you're talking about names and like, do we have a list of names? Yes, we do. But also, like, how do we make our characters distinct from each other? You know, now we have more than 27 female characters we've written, because there's multiple characters in each book, and we have to make sure that each one feels fully realized and distinct. Mm-hmm. And that just takes a while.
Oh my God. I mean, yeah. So. I mean, you mentioned creating a world. I mean, it's an entire process and research that goes into creating a whole world. And it's so interesting to me that you guys share it so well. It blends both of your brains into this world, and you both can visualize it and see it together. It's incredible. Okay, before we get into rapid fire, I need to ask about the sex scenes, because I'm so fascinated by authors that can write really great sex scenes, only because I think if done poorly, it can come off very cheesy and cringy almost. So is there something that you have to do in order to write a good sex scene, or is there a formula? Like, what goes into it? I know we talked a little bit about, obviously, the woman is at the forefront. There's consent. There's female pleasure. At least that every romance novel I've read in the past couple years, it's always been about more of the female is the star in it, which is so refreshing. It's sad that it's refreshing, but it is. So we'd love to hear a little bit about your process of, like, the actual mechanics of writing something like that.
I think that for us, the sex is dependent on the characters. So, like, the things that they say and the things that they do have to relate to those characters. So, like, Unhoneymooners is one of our, like, most closed door books. And we tried to make that book sexier, but it just doesn't work because that's not who Olive and Ethan are. So they have to say things that make sense for them and do things. And then for us, it's not just like the physical parts of what's happening. It's like everything that's going on in their head and what they can hear and what they can see and how this is going to change things that happen tomorrow and, you know, all of that. So, and we have words we don't like in sex scenes and ways we like things done. And so, it changes for every book. And I don't know, Lo, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. I think you it's something you get to be comfortable with over time. And because we wrote fan fiction first, and there was this anonymous safety net of, like, you can write something and nobody knows that it's Lauren Billings in California. You know, they just know it as this pen name. So you can be daring, you can be kind of brave and try stuff. And I think because we had both written so much sexy stuff before we published, we had this understanding of, like, okay, I know people have historically found this stuff for me to work pretty well. And so we just try and get better over time. Sometimes that means the books are sexier and sometimes it means they're less sexy, but it has to fit the characters. You'll find, I mean, in romance, you'll find books where, like,
yeah.
And I mean, I can't think of a single name right now, so I'm not calling anybody out, but, like, you'll read a book where she's, like, been raised in a small town and this is her first sexual experience. And she's, like, in the very first scene, she's like riding that. A reverse cowgirl and, like, you know, saying, like, dirty stuff. And it doesn't fit the person. Like, it really has to fit the character, and right. It can't read like every other sex scene that you've written before. So I think that's a lot of it, is you have to think about who these people are and what they are giving each other, and also what they're kind of like, what ground they're losing or gaining in this sex to move the story forward. It can't just be a scene that you plug in, right?
That's so true. It has to have some sort of meaning or some sort of progression through the story. I totally mm-hmm. agree with that.
Yeah, like in Beautiful Bastard, they have sex in the first chapter, I think. I mean, within the first few, like, 10 pages at least. And, like, but the tension in that book isn't resolved until the end, because that is the only time that they are ever real with each other, you know? And so they have to figure out how to be vulnerable when they're not in that space. And that's what's hard for them. Whereas other people, you know, they work their way up to feeling comfortable enough to have sex with somebody, and so the sex happens later in the book. It just depends on the
It's usually, you know, that tension breaking is the sex scene at the end. It's like this whole thing that builds up to it. But that's interesting that if they have sex earlier on the book, like, there, I mean, I just read The Roommate by Rosie Dolan. They don't have sex, but he, you know, makes her come very, very early on, and I but of course there is this
underlying tension that continues. And it's not even about that scene. It was just this, their relationship deepening to a point at the end where they actually fall in love. And then it's this like beautiful experience. But I totally see that it has to work for each of the character for sure.
Yeah. And that's a great example too, because in that book, I mean, it's very sex positive. He is a porn star, you know,
so it makes sense that,
and so she's sort of falling for him, but also, you know, she's like, this guy does this for a living. I am nothing to him. Yeah. Like, this is life altering experiences for me. And for him, it's like 20 minutes at the job. Right. So like, you know, she has to reckon with that sort of feeling of like, can I measure up? This is really great. Like, and also, you know, just trusting that he is this total perfect golden retriever dude. He's so sweet. I love him.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. It's a really good, that's a very good.
Okay. So let's do a little bit of rapid fire before we get going. I love to ask this question because I just love to hear people's perspective on this. What does literary success look like to you?
One of the things that I love is I will see a tweet. This is the thing that like makes me the most happy. Somebody will say, I'm looking for a book that is something, something. And I will see, read this book and anything by Christina Lauren.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, that's for us, we're on book 27. So just having readers still show up for book 28, to me, that's success, right? If we still have people who are tweeting us, and we do, every day, I've been reading you since fan fiction. That is like, to me, that's success. If you carry your readers forward, that's it.
I love it. Okay. What is your favorite underappreciated novel?
Of ours or of any in the genre?
Either.
Okay.
Or no, let's do yours since you guys have, I mean, a bajillion.
Okay. I would say Dating You, Hating You. It was our first standalone romance and it's super funny and I love them so much. And I think readers were used to series from us. So they kind of, it was like sort of like a weird speed bump kind of changing gears to start with a completely new thing and not be doing series. But I do think it's actually one of our best books we've ever written.
It's hilarious. It's our sort of like take on 9 to 5, mm-hmm. but it came out like right at the election in 2016 and before me too. So I almost feel like it was a little ahead, mm-hmm. Because there's like a terrible boss and sexism in the workplace and stuff. And that book cracks me up. So I would love for more people to find it.
Oh my God, for sure. Okay. That's next on my list. Thank you for giving me that rec. okay. We said you edited it out the actual number that they are, their compatibility score, their actual one at the end. But is there anything else that you edited out of this book?
We had a couple of scenes that we cut or trimmed down a lot because it was just wordier. Mm. Our editor really wanted us to get to the first date by a certain point. And so we had a lot of scenes where we had more scenes of Jess and Fizzy just being ridiculous. And they were great. It was kind of a kill your darling situation because they were really great scenes, but they also didn't move things forward. And so those were probably ones that we trimmed down.
I could have read a whole book on just them too. I mean, let's make Fizzy the main character. Let's bring her back. A follow up.
Yeah, we are hearing that, and I think, you know, we're considering how we could do it. The thing about Fizzy is that she's a romance writer, so we wouldn't want it to feel a little too like inside jokey. You know, we want readers to feel like they aren't in on the joke if we write about a romance author. Or we wouldn't want it to feel like Beach Reed, too on the nose.
Emily Henry did kind of a similar thing with Beach Read, where she's a romance novelist, but
yeah, in that story, which is a great book, January is not zany in the way that Fizzy is.
Right. Totally.
So Fizzy is just a big personality and she's funny and she's big and she's brave. And that works really easily as a side character because you don't have to get into her head and find her vulnerabilities. But once you chip away at people's external humor and defenses a little, they're more like bare. And so figuring out a way to make Fizzy who she is without losing that edge, I think is what would be the tricky thing in making her a main character.
Yeah. Well, as a fellow ecstatic person and big personality. Would love to see your take on that, of chipping away at the,
yes.
at the exterior. Would love it. I feel like it would be meta for me, so that's great. Okay, last one. What was the hardest scene to write?
Probably the opening. I think we did that for a really long time. This book is in third person. And third person passed. And so we were drafting it that way and it just wasn't working. It just didn't feel like it had any voice. And so we decided to draft it in first person, present tense, to make sure it sounded like Jess, like sounded like somebody that you would know. And then we went back when we were done and rewrote it in third person past tense. I should say,
I was gonna
low.
Say, what,
went back.
Do you like literally
and made
have
those
to
changes.
Go, wor- like, well, yeah, you have to go word for word and change it.
Yeah, yeah, because it's not just like changing, you know, I to she. Yeah.
Yeah. It's you rewrite the book, but it's already there. But so you the thing is when you're doing a polish, when you're doing line edits, you're rewriting anyway. You're already revising every sentence. So it's tedious to do that, but it is also, I felt like in this case was worth it because we really figured out who Jess was. And then we kind of were able to take a step back in the narration.
And it really made a difference. It read differently doing it that way, as opposed to trying to draft it that way.
So interesting is it's actually something I don't notice, which I, maybe that's the point, is that I don't notice that it's either first person or third. Do you guys gravitate towards one or the other? Or is it just really dependent on the story and the character?
Well, we had most of our stuff has been written first person.
Right.
Since Dating You, Hating You, it's all been first person present tense. Love and Other Words, there's alternating past and present, but it's all first person. And so I think that that's a more natural voice for us. And that's very common in romance. It's very sort of experiential. But, you know, when you're, this was our first book in hardcover. And so when you're going for a commercial audience is more accustomed to reading third person. They might not realize that. People, readers might not know that about themselves, but that's something that like the industry is aware of. And so our editor was like, listen, just so you know, like most people who read in hardcover are going to be familiar with third person. And so first person might just read a little too like genre to them, right? Yeah. And so it was just something we tried and it worked and it was fun. I think we've maybe heard one person say, I miss first person, but most people say either don't notice or are like, I love this. So
that is so fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. Little in the more you know.
And it was crazy when she did the first chapter and sent it, we were just like, oh my God, this reads so like, I don't know. Money.
Yeah.
Because we always say that. We're like with like something.
Selling out. I'm writing.
No. Not like that. Just like it just read so much more like
polished.
Yeah.
There's something. I can understand that it could feel like more mature in a way. I don't know. Yeah. It feels like you're like an observer in a way, but still in it. That's so interesting. All right. Let everyone know where they can find you both. You mentioned Twitter. Can people tweet at you? Can people reach you there? Let everyone know where they can find you.
On Twitter and Instagram, we are Christina Lauren. Mm-hmm. On Facebook, we are Christina Lauren Books. And then we have a Facebook group called C-Low and Friends. And it's just a bunch of awesome people who just talk all day.
I mean, makes sense. Yep. I'll be joining that ASAP. Thank you ladies so much for doing this. This is like a dream of mine. I have been reading your books for so long. And so I'm so happy that you guys were able to come and do this with me. The sisters are, our audience is going to freak out when they hear from you. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was super fun. Thanks for having us.
Have a good one.
You too.
You too.
Bye.
Do you ever feel like you're struggling through motherhood? You're not alone. I'm Erica Jossa, host of the MomWell podcast, therapist and mom of three. Join me each Wednesday as I sit down with guests, including psychologists, pediatricians, psychiatrists, fertility specialists, lactation consultants, and more to unravel the myths of motherhood. With expert advice, practical tips, self-love, and some coping skills to help you along the way, you can become the mother you want to be. Listen to the MomWell podcast at momwell.com/listen or on your favorite podcast platform.